Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. Think corporations are out of control? You can do something about it. Ask this guy.
They actually encourage companies to make a change.
That's Tim Smith. He says certain types of activism can grab a corporation's attention.
They actually encourage companies to make a change.
So what action is so effective? Is it A, shareholder activism? Every year, companies respond to about a third of shareholder resolutions. Or is it B, celebrity boycotts? PETA's star-studded anti-fur campaign made Ralph Lauren switch to faux fur. Or is it effective to impose C, government regulations? New reports show the Sarbanes-Oxley reforms have made companies more trustworthy to investors. Stumped? Take action and get the answer on this week's Marketplace Money. It's up next from American Public Media.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money.
The saying goes that if you don't vote, you have no right to complain about the things you could have voted on. So when's the last time you actually cast a vote for the board of directors of a company in your mutual fund? I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
In this time of wild market swings, you may actually want to take a look at those proxy statements you get in the mail if you own stock or a mutual fund. You know, the ones you probably take out of the envelope and toss right in the recycling bin. Regulators are looking at a major overhaul of the system that allows you, as a stockholder, to vote on company issues. The SEC has proposed two very different rules about investors having a say in who's on the board. But many shareholder advocates worry it's just the start of some big changes. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
The next proposal is one regarding compensation disparity.
This is the sound of corporate democracy at work.
Representing the Benedictine Sisters of Boerne, Texas. Welcome, Sister Micah.
At Walmart's annual meeting a few months ago, investors submitted 11 shareholder resolutions. They called on the board to expand health care coverage for workers and to disclose the company's political and charitable contributions. None of them passed, but shareholder activists see these proposals as an essential way to communicate with management and directors. Tim Smith chairs the Social Investment Forum. The nonprofit group promotes socially responsible investing. He says each year, shareholders end up withdrawing up to a third of their proposals because boards respond to investors' concerns.
These resolutions aren't just trying to, quote, send a message to the boardroom. They actually are a very creative stimulus to encourage companies to make a change.
Now shareholders worry their rights to have a say in company matters are in danger. The SEC is considering two competing changes to proxy rules. One would clarify a current rule. It essentially prevents shareholders from adding their own board candidates to a company's proxy statement. The other would clear the way for shareholders to nominate their own directors. But investors would have to own at least 5% of the stock in order to do so.
5% of a large public company, a Fortune 500 company, is a huge amount of stock.
Jill Fish teaches business law at Fordham Law School.
There are very few shareholders that own 5%. And since all we're talking about is a procedural proposal that the other stockholders have to approve, why should you need 5%? If it's a bad proposal, the other stockholders can vote it down.
As part of its proposal on director nominations, the SEC has also raised questions about the nature of shareholder proposals themselves. Currently, an investor must own $2,000 in a company's stock to submit a proposal. The commission wonders if that should be increased to $4,000 or $10,000. The SEC also asks if it should be harder for shareholders to resubmit proposals that have failed in past years. Amy Goodman, with the law firm Gibson Dunn, represents corporations in securities cases. She says shareholders get to vote on the big issues, like mergers or board elections.
But when it comes to routine day-to-day decisions, it's just not realistic to expect shareholders to be able to have a large say. I think their say comes through electing the directors who act in their interest.
With all the recent corporate scandals, many may wonder if directors always act in their shareholders' interests. A spokesman for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce says stockholders have plenty of ways to communicate with board members without resorting to proxy votes. But social investor Tim Smith asks, what about companies like this one?
A company in New York, Dover, this year, where Walden Asset Management had a shareholder resolution, held a stockholders meeting, and they asked us not to come because they didn't want to have any shareholders present. Is this an example of a company that's listening to its shareholders?
The public has until October 2nd to comment on the SEC's proposals. Chairman Christopher Cox has promised a final rule sometime this fall. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement and by the FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant making and educational funding online at finrafoundation.org.
It's just about time to send the kids back to school. How many bake sales do you think you'll attend this year? How many magazines and cookies and candy bars will you buy? How much money will you spend on stuff you don't want or need just so your kids' school doesn't take the axe to the music department? School fundraisers are big business in this country, and districts are relying on them more and more as government funding gets scarcer and scarcer. Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
9-year-old Cooper Reynolds attends public school in San Clemente, California. Students there are asked to do several fundraisers a year. He's sold everything from chocolates to cookie dough to wrapping paper.
I want to help the school, but I also like to get, like, a little prize or something like that once I try to get the DVD player.
Cooper's mother, Beth Eagleson, had a hard time explaining to her son that to score the DVD player, he would have to sell a lot of wrapping paper. And Eagleson was sick of doing most of the work herself. Because the school wouldn't let the kids sell door-to-door or set up on the sidewalk, she ended up selling the stuff to her colleagues and relatives. So Eagleson told Cooper's principal that her son would not participate in any more school fundraisers.
It's really not appropriate to have little children funding their own educations. They're giving kindergartners and first graders and second graders these sales quotas.
Those little kids sell big, though, or at least their parents do. Fundraisers like these generate more than $2 billion a year. But schools only keep about half of that. The rest goes to the companies that provide the products. Still, schools need the money. State and federal funds make up less and less of public schools' operating budgets, and schools like Cooper's are relying more and more on private giving. PTA member Liz Dubelman helps raise money for her daughter's school in Santa Monica, California.
It's a major chunk of the school's budget. It's a very, very big chunk.
Dubelman's school doesn't make students sell products, but she says that means a lot of blood, sweat, and tears for PTA parents. Dubelman's school organizes a Halloween carnival, a student art auction, a book fair, and in the winter it even carts in snow so the Southern California kids can have the chance to sled and build snowmen. The activities bring in tens of thousands of dollars every year. Dubelman says she has no quibble with the schools asking parents for money.
Education is free to a certain degree and not so free that you don't have to think about it.
But even schools with less active PTAs are finding ways around selling cookie dough. Charles Best taught social studies in the Bronx for 5 years. When he got frustrated with the school's lack of resources, he founded DonorsChoose.org. Teachers write up a project they need money for, and parents, companies, and anybody else can give.
Our reason for being is the growing skepticism of donors who feel that if they write a $10 check or a $100 check, it may be going into a black hole.
Best says more than 27,000 teachers have posted projects on Donors Choose over the last 7 years, and people have donated $13 million.
I really do think that teachers get a whole lot more bang for their effort compared to, you know, going door to door, selling candy bars and having, you know, 60% of the proceeds go elsewhere.
Cooper's mother, Beth Eagleson, took a similar approach at her son's school.
And as a parent who wanted to support classroom activities and art supplies, whatever it was, it made more sense just to find out what the need was from the school and write a check.
Eagleson likes seeing the direct impact of the money she gives. Best of all, she doesn't have to worry about what to do with a freezer full of cookie dough. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace Money.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Yes, that may be true, but here at Marketplace Money, summer school is in session. We've certainly learned a lot these last few weeks, things like PMI, short sale, consumer sentiment. But you know what goes along with school, don't you? Here's your first pop quiz.
Aww.
All right, all right. Who can tell me the definition of a bond? All right, a show of hands if your answer was a fixed income security. Excellent. This week, we'll learn a little more about bonds, the difference between price and yield. At the Blackboard this week, economist Greg McBride.
The price of a bond is the price at which the bond is currently trading, and the yield reflects the return that investors will earn if they buy that bond and hold it until it matures. Now, what happens is that prices fluctuate on an almost daily basis in markets, and as the prices fluctuate, so too do the yields. People often wonder, why if a bond price rises, does the bond yield fall? With a bond, you know what you're going to get when the bond matures. And when you pay a higher price, the yield that you're going to earn between now and when it matures is actually lower than if you had purchased the bond prior to that increase in price. As bond yields rise, those yields become more attractive relative to the returns that investors could get someplace else, such as in stocks. In the opposite vein, if bond yields are falling, that makes stocks more attractive. When yields are rising and prices are falling, that makes buying much more attractive. But it's not necessarily a good time to be selling those bonds because, after all, you're getting a lower price today than you would have the day before. Now look at the rising yield. That has different implications for consumers. For example, when the yield on a 10-year Treasury note rises, fixed mortgage rates often rise right along with it. So rising bond yields actually make those mortgages that homebuyers are out there getting more expensive. The inverse is true as well. If bond yields fall, so too do mortgage rates.
Our teacher this week was Greg McBride. He's a senior analyst for Bankrate.com. Next week, rebalancing your portfolio. What does that mean? Strap in, everybody. A fast and furious mailbag is ready to go. The speed round is back. And we spend a day in the work life of a used car dealer who won't take you for a ride.
The engine is solid. It runs real good. Check that.
It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Baseball, apple pie, and Toyota? Last month, a Japanese car manufacturer seized the number two slot in American auto sales. Only GM sells more cars in this country. And Toyota's set to surpass GM as the biggest car maker this year. But we've still got the biggest car market. And on this week's A Day in the Work Life, we speak with an American who can get you a deal on one. As you'll learn, though, this car salesman's really one of a kind.
You know, this right here got 131,000 on it. It's got the 2.7 dual overhead cam. The engine is solid. It runs real good. Check that. My name is Willie Scales. My age is 48. And my job title is owner of Willie Auto Finance, LLC, and Auto Repair. We'll pull the hood, then we'll take a look around here, show you the engine that's on it. How did I end up in this business? I was working for the City of Grand Rapids, Parks and Recreation. Dave Roberts asked me if I wanted to sell cars. This was the summer of 98, and he was like, you know, you're a people kind of guy. And he, you know, he brought me in and showed me the ropes, and I was doing really good. I was selling cars for him, and the first week of November, my vision went funny on me. The next day, I went in and I told him, I said, I'm going blind. My spirit was broke. Because I felt really bad. But then I started talking to my caseworker, Michelle Vischer, and she was like, well, why not do your own business? And my spirit came up. But then once I did that, it realized that, hey, this is a lot of work. I had to get a sense of basically everything around me, you know, knowing where the cars was on the lot. That was a task in itself. Then you got to remember what the mileage is on them. Then you have to remember what color they are. I have to surround myself with people that I can trust, that don't try to pull pranks on me. Because, you know, if it's got something to do with a car, it's not a prank. This is business, so we got to treat it like a business. The Commission for the Blind, they came in and they had me set up like where the computer would talk to do pretty much everything I need as far as my car deals, to scan driving license to make sure their license is good before they go out on the test drive.
L license number NS240-1107-5970-01.
I'm overseeing everything. Nothing get done without my okay. Right now, the commission, they paying my lights, gas, and rent. They gonna do it for 6 months until I start to generate my business, and then I'll take over. Because this is a new business and everything, pretty much everything that you're doing right now goes back into the business. My salary would be somewhere around $500 a week. Right now, I'm just having too much fun. When I close in the afternoon, and I go home to my family and I play with my daughter, and you know, I'm just stretching out there on the couch, I'm ready to come back to work. Because, I mean, I just have so much fun here.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Christina Shockley.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
A rude awakening brings us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, payment in kind note. A payment in kind note is when a company uses a bond instead of cash to pay interest they owe. Kind of like paying a debt with an IOU. Well, very kind indeed. Payment in kind notes are usually given by large private equity firms to investment bankers that lend them money. But thanks to the credit meltdown, more of these notes are being refused, and Standard & Poor's says banks accepting them might not get their money's worth. That's what you get for depending on the kindness of strangers. Hi, everyone. I'm your host, Tess Vigeland, and it's that time again, the time where we answer your burning financial questions. And Chris Farrell is here, of course. Most of you know him as our economics expert. Welcome, Chris.
I'm hot to go, Tess.
You are. Oh, most excellent. Well, before we get to the questions, though, let's give out the website address. It's marketplace.org. Click on the contact button there. Or you can give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And usually, at this point, we go right to a caller, Chris. But this week, we are going to continue the challenge of Chris Farrell versus the clock. Yes, mailbag fans, it's time once again for the speed round of death. All right, that's maybe a bit too dramatic. Anyway, in this corner, a stopwatch. In the other, the brain of Chris Farrell. You ready to answer 5 questions in 5 minutes?
I'm ready.
Well, you know, you successfully defended your crown last time. So if you're ready. Question number 1, Scott from Minneapolis, Minnesota. After 2.5 years in the corporate world, he decided to go back for grad school, and he happily stowed away $14,000 in his company 401k. Should he roll it into an IRA or take the tax hit and use the money for grad school? Go.
Roll it over into an IRA. Save that money for your retirement. You're going to grad school. You're going to earn a higher income when you graduate, so don't touch it.
All right, there you go. Question number 2, Carol from Brookline, Massachusetts. Very common question we get here. How do you find a good financial advisor? What are some of the things to look out for?
Oh, now this is a whole show, but just to narrow
it down.
You don't
have the whole show, my friend.
I don't have the whole show.
In fact, you have
okay.
4 minutes and 18 seconds.
I like fee-only financial advisors. 2 sources, the National Association of Personal Financial Advisors. There's also the Financial Planning Association. You can go on the web. Check them out. You want a fee-only financial advisor. You also want a certified financial planner. That's a level of education that should give you some confidence. That's one route. The other route, talk to people you respect, people you know.
Who have financial advisors.
You know, people that you think are really smart and sort of know what they're doing. Get their recommendations. Interview a lot of people. Now let's say you find 5 of them, ethical, good financial planners. How do you choose? It's the one you're most comfortable with. This is an intimate relationship, so you want to enjoy working with this person.
All right, and we'll have links to those websites on our website. All right, question number 3, Jennifer from Indianapolis, Indiana. She has a few credit cards with a high credit limit, but she's paid them off, and she's got an excellent credit rating, but wants to know if having all this credit available to her represents a problem if she's going to seek a home loan. Does it look like she's credit greedy?
No, in the looking glass world of credit scoring, she looks good. She looks really good because think about this score. One of the things that improves a score is having a nice big gap between the credit that you use and your credit limit. So that shows that you are nice and responsible, but the credit card companies, they're willing to give you a very high credit limit. So it's actually she's in a very good situation. The fact that she's not taking advantage of a credit limit also shows that she's smart with her money. People, just because a credit card company gives you a big limit, don't take advantage of it. That's an easy way to financially hang yourself.
All right. Well, we better take advantage of the fact that we only have 2.5 minutes left. David from Arlington, Virginia, 15 years ago, he ran up about $5,000 in credit card debt. Couldn't pay it off. The issuer canceled the card. And, of course, that stayed on his credit report until it was taken off. But recently, another company bought that old debt, again from years ago, and is now coming after him for it. How long can this debt stay on the books and have somebody come after you for it?
Tessa, you notice that we're getting this question more and more?
We certainly are.
And this has to do, it's called zombie debt. And in today's world, people are buying debt that in the old days, you know, just wouldn't pay any attention to. So what do? There's a couple of things. First of all, hang up. Do not engage in a conversation. That's the first thing you do. Secondly, go to bankrate.com and look at the statute of limitations in your state, because the details vary state by state. So you may be past the statute of limitations. That's a very key thing to do. If you do end up in a struggle with your debt collector, you want to know your rights. You want to write them if you're going to deal with them. I prefer the hang-up method, but if you're going to deal with them, do everything in writing. Negotiate carefully and keep a close eye on your credit report.
All right. 1 minute, 10 seconds to go. We've got 1 question left. Olympia from Omaha, Nebraska. She has about $40,000 in student loan debt. She's really worried she's never going to be able to pay it off. Is this cause for concern? I would guess yes. What should she do to get the monkey off her back?
Well, hopefully, you know, for most people, as they get older, they earn more money, allows them to attack their student loan debt. There are a couple things that I would also suggest. One, look into research. I'm not saying that this is necessarily the right thing to do, but look into consolidating the loan. I'd also go to the website FinAid, and they have an interesting discussion of perhaps the income contingent repayment.
30 seconds.
Or also the income sensitive repayment, which means you pay a percentage of your income to go pay for your debt. It lasts for 25 years, but it may buy you some time. So go to FinAid, research your options, buy yourself some time, and hopefully as you age, you earn more income and can pay off the debt.
Chris, you made it. Give us a hand, folks. Well done, my friend. All right. Well, if you've got any other personal finance questions, please let us help you out. Click on the contact button on our website, marketplace.org, or call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. All right, Chris, you know what? Our work is not done, my friend. Speed rounder,
right.
No. We've got a caller on the line. You ready?
You're a taskmaster, I got to tell you.
Yes. Well, Daniel has a question, and he's from Wake Forest, North Carolina. Welcome to the program, Dan.
Thank you.
So we've just been through the speed round, and I guess you've got a question for us.
I do. How can I leverage some savings that I have in order to purchase a business? The businesses that I'm interested in buying, you know, run from $350,000 to $500,000, and I don't have that much saved. And I wondered if there was some sort of opportunity that I may be missing to kind of leverage that money as I would if I was going to be buying a house.
How much do you have saved?
I have about $50,000.
$50,000?
Yeah.
And what kind of business are you hoping to run?
A landscape maintenance business.
Well, Chris, what do you think?
Well, just one additional question, Dan. Is this a business that you have experience in? Is this what you're doing right now, but you want to make it something much bigger?
No, I don't own a business presently. I work for one. And what I'd like to do is be my own boss.
Okay. In every state that I'm aware of, there's an association of nurserymen, because a lot of this is going to have to do with networking and find people who might be willing to invest in you or believe in you.
Chris, what about the Small Business Administration? Isn't this just what they do, grants and loans for this type of thing?
Right. In most communities, particularly where there's a university, and we know there's in Wake Forest, there's Wake Forest University, the Small Business Administration has these small business development centers around the country, and they're little tiny think tanks. And so they're perfect for someone like Daniel to go to and say, here's what I'm thinking about doing. And they'll really help you develop a business plan. They'll help you go through what are the possible loan options. Another group, which is also around the country, is called SCORE.
I've heard you mention them on the program before.
Right. And they're typically very good. I mean, these are retired executives. They typically are running small businesses. They were successful small business owners, and they want to give back to the community. And it's under the auspices of the Small Business Administration. So if you go to sba.gov, you can easily find either the Small Business Development Centers or the SCORE offices that are in your area.
All right. I have one other angle on this. My wife is a recent immigrant to the United States, and I wondered if there were philanthropic foundations that might exist to help, you know, the new immigrants coming into the country who might want to start their own business. Do you have any ideas in that regard?
A couple of thoughts. Nonprofits are very important. And mentioning your wife, like there's a nonprofit that'd be very useful. It's a group called Ladies Who Launch. And these are women who are successful entrepreneurs, and they're in a lot of communities, and they really focus on helping women start their own business and impart a lot of knowledge. And so that can be, again, a very useful resource for you to tap into.
All right. Does that help you out, Daniel?
Oh, Chris, you've been great. Very thorough. It helps me out a lot.
Fantastic. Well, best of luck with trying to launch your own business, and let us know how it goes.
I will.
Thanks for the call.
Bye.
Bye. Trying to improve your finances by starting out on a new career? Well, it'll take a lot of preparation and information, but you never know. It could pay off big time. And if you need help figuring out what should be your first step, give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or visit our website, marketplace.org, and click on the button that says Contact. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right, our next caller is Tim from Panama City, Florida. Hi, Tim.
Good morning.
How you doing down there in Florida?
It's hot.
Is it hot? Is it wet as well?
Humid.
No hurricanes, though, so far this year.
I'm keeping my fingers crossed.
Right. Well, tell us what your question is for Chris today.
Well, essentially what it amounts to is I'm having problems with our insurance. Last year, my wife and I did have our insurance to the state of Florida because the age of our house is so old it's rather hard to get insurance for our house. And then we were notified when it was coming up for the end of our policy that they had sold our policy to another company. We got our quote from them. It was for essentially about $2,800 for the year. We had our house inspected as they instructed us to, and they gave us a discount of around about $350 to $400, which dropped it down to around about $2,400. We had already given them our down payment, and we had to finance the remainder of it because it was a rather large sum at one time. And then about 30 to 45 days past that, they sent us a letter basically stating that their underwriters said that we could not, or they could not insure our house for that amount, and that they would need an additional $1,700 or they would drop our policy.
Did they give you a reason?
They just said that it was not enough.
Wow, Chris, doesn't the company have to honor an initial quote or not?
Now, did you talk to anyone in the company or have any correspondence with them?
Well, we called them. And yeah. They essentially basically told us that if we did not pay the extra $1,700, that they would drop our policy. And we considered it at the time to try to find another insurance company on a rather quick basis. But unfortunately, because when they cancel your policy like that, they also get to keep all kinds of processing fees and whatnot like that. And we would lose roughly about half of what we had or half of our policy for the whole year.
My first thing would be, you want to keep your insurance. If it were me, I would pay it, and I would also consult with an attorney. And I would also file a complaint with the state attorneys general, because there's a lot of investigations going on looking into all the games property casualty insurance companies are doing right now. Florida is one of the places they're doing some of the worst stuff. My main concern would be not to, however, to lose the policy.
Chris, is there any way just in general for folks to reduce their premiums?
This is a big thing because premiums since the 2004, 2005 hurricanes have gone up. And there are a couple things that people should at least, you know, on their checklist go through. If you increase your deductible, in other words, how much you're going to be out of pocket, mm-hmm. you can usually lower your premium. Second thing that is highly recommended, combining your homeowners with your auto policy.
Because the company then gives you some sort of discount for having all of that with them.
Yes, it's good for them. And so they'll give you a discount. And then, of course, as Tim is mentioning, shop around. And my recommendation would be for Tim to shop around for next year, not for this year.
I agree.
All right. Does that help you out?
Very much so.
Okay. Thanks so much for the call.
Thank you.
Well, unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take for this show. But please do leave your questions for a future program on our voicemail. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Again, we spell that M-O-N-Y. Or head to our website, we're at marketplace.org, and click on the contact button. Chris, thanks as always for the great information.
Thanks a lot.
Up next, a visit with our Seattle Investment Club. They're getting up close and personal with the price-to-earnings ratio.
I would say if you're going to invest, get to know your PE, get to understand what happens to PE. It can be a very healthy relationship, or it can sometimes be up and down, as you say.
And a new twist on socially responsible investing, anti-terror mutual funds. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Back now to our investment club series. We're following three clubs, one in Seattle, another in San Jose, and a third in Fairfax, Virginia, as they figure out what stocks to buy, sell, and hold throughout the year.
The stock didn't do very well.
What sectors do you buy?
Prices are going to continue to go up.
Join the club.
It's been a little more than 3 months since our last trip to Seattle. The Meridian Pacific Club has six members who meet once a week.
There you go.
I would like a call out to Americana.
Four members are here at the coffee joint Vivace. Nathan Bugia, who's been the stalwart for all three of our visits, plus Mohit Srivastav, Sumit Lohia, and Sumit Sen. I asked how they'd reacted to a market drop of more than 500 points the week before.
We all know pretty much everybody's major holdings,
So when something happens on somebody else's major holding or a big market-wide event, somebody always sends a mail.
So what was the initial reaction?
There are actually other things that were going on last week that we were more concerned about than the drop. So some of us are big shareholders in Microsoft. We had a good week last week. And some other companies like Google that we invested in had a bad week last week. Those sent off some of our alarms.
But the market drop didn't?
A little bit. But when we look at market stuff, we're all invested in a diverse number of index funds. So when something happens at a market level, there's not really much we can do immediately. And if it were to continue to fall this week, then we'd be a lot more anxious today. It was back
then. One logistical thing. If you sell a short-term holding in response to a 4% drop, you're going to pay ordinary income tax. If you hold on to it, let it become a long-term holding, the amount of tax you're paying is significantly less.
About individual stock holdings then, not, say, a mutual fund, a retirement fund?
Generally speaking, that's true, yeah.
What about you two?
Well, it definitely made me want to go back and look at the fundamentals and see if something had changed and really ask questions about, you know, what was the reason behind the drop? Is it something that there's a fundamental reason to panic, or is it that, you know, there's a profit taking, you know, and what percent of the drop was profit taking? And personally, I think that's really healthy. That's on the pro side. On the con side, the credit concerns. As a metaphor, it's like termites. I don't know if that's like a handful of termites and we've kind of dealt with the problem, or if the whole foundation is getting eaten away at slowly.
As we know now, some 3 weeks later, there was more than a handful of termites. So how are the club members' investments doing in 2007?
So my name is Nathan, and my return was 5.8% this year, post-drop.
Do you know what it was before last week?
Yes, it was 11.2%.
Wow.
Yeah.
But you're long-term, right?
Absolutely. It's all funny money. It's only a number in my brokerage account that has no bearing on my life today. And when I turn 65, hopefully it's still a good number.
How about you, Smith?
My returns this year are actually on the lower side. A large percent of that is just I have not been putting the time into managing the investments actively. I've been more in a capital preservation mode. And I made a fairly large investment in IIF, which is one of the India funds, that went down a lot, you know, right after I invested in it. And
When did you invest in it?
I invested in it almost a year ago. And it's just high. It was a high point and it sort of got hit. But I believe in the fund long term. So I'm not unhappy with being, you know, an owner of that fund, but that really dragged my investment average down. So I'm actually probably south of where Nathan is right now.
I don't have my numbers exact, but it was over 5% and less than 10%. So somewhere between 5 or 10%.
Do you know what kind of hit you took last week?
No.
You went up last week.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Because of Amazon.
Yes.
And we made him buy us all beer. So that may have taken it back down a little bit.
Lohio wasn't terribly worried about what was happening in the rest of his portfolio because his Amazon shares, he works there, saw a 26% bump the week before. So any final advice from this group of investors? Sumit Sen volunteered that it all comes down to a stock's price-to-earnings ratio.
I would say if you're going to invest, get to know your PE, get to understand what happens to PE.
It sounds like a potential spouse. Get to know them.
It can be a very healthy relationship, or it can sometimes be up and down, as you say.
Not sure what a PE is? Check out our summer school definition from a few weeks ago. It's at marketplace.org. You can also find archives of our entire investment club series, including advice on how to start one of your own.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
People these days want more from their mutual funds than a big return. They want to make the world a better place. Socially responsible investing has been around for quite a while, but now it's got a new angle. Terrorism-free investing. Bob Frick is with Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine, and he's written about these new funds. And Bob, how common is this investing method?
It's a very young business right now. As a matter of fact, as far as we can tell, there's only two that are offered to the general public. But Basically, the broad definition is a fund that does not invest in companies that invest in Iran, North Korea, Sudan, and Syria.
Is this what we generally think of as socially responsible investing, only just taking it to the terror level?
Well, I think because it's so new, we're defining it even as we speak, but I think it's a brand new wrinkle on socially responsible investing. A lot of people are going to find this a much clearer and more interesting prospect if you're actually going to try and influence things in the world through your investing.
How do they determine what to include and what to exclude? Because a lot of times you're talking about companies with subsidiaries that perhaps do business that the parent company doesn't, and that sort of thing. Is there a benchmark that they use?
Basically, it is either a very big list or a very small list. Florida, for example, says we're not going to invest in any companies that do business with Iran, specifically oil companies. And that's only about, I think, 18 or 19 companies. Mm. But the list can be as long as 500 companies if you take it to companies that simply sell products in one of these, you know, terror countries, terrorist states, as they're called. So maybe Coca-Cola would make the list.
Right, because I'm guessing that they drink Coca-Cola in Syria.
Or North Korea.
Yeah. So, for example, you talk in the article about the Roosevelt Anti-Terror Multicap Fund. How do they make sure that their investments are clean of terror-related companies?
Well, they've hired a consulting firm, which basically helps them determine who these companies are. It's called the Conflict Securities Advisories Group. And a lot of companies are starting to do business with them. And you go to them and you say, I want a very strict definition, or I want a very loose definition of what an anti-terror investment would be.
With any model of socially responsible investing, the flip side of that is, well, you know, how do they do in the market? How has the Roosevelt Fund done in terms of results?
Well, it's a great fund to begin with. And so far, their terror spin hasn't affected their results at all. But see, here's the thing. Most of these companies are based overseas. So as long as you're mainly a domestic fund, which the Roosevelt Fund is, you're basically not going to be sacrificing anything to put this anti-terror moniker on there.
So you could go to any number of mutual funds then and say, we're anti-terror just by default.
True, but there are some U.S. firms that, depending on your definition, would count as helping or doing business with terror-sponsoring states. General Electric, Halliburton, both have subsidiaries that do business with some of these firms. You have Siemens, the big German engineering company, which actually is starting to succumb to pressure to pull out of doing business with Iran. But domestically, you have ConocoPhillips, Halliburton, GE. You could all say, at least tangentially, are involved with some of these countries.
Is it possible to quantify what kind of effect this effort could have? I mean, does it work in terms of forcing change?
Well, it certainly hasn't worked yet because it's just getting off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
I think the model you have to look at is South Africa. Now, when people started thinking that we should not invest in companies that do business with South Africa, it kind of got a slow start. But once it picked up steam, South Africa kind of came a pariah among the international investment community. Changes were made. Corporations changed how they did business, and it really did bring some pressure on South Africa.
Bob Frick is senior editor at Kiplinger's Personal Finance. Thanks again for coming in.
You're welcome.
Saving for life's big events is something we talk about a lot on the program. College tuition, retirement plans, and perhaps the biggest party you'll ever throw, a wedding. If you're thinking, cha-ching, don't let our commentator know. Michelle Phillippe wants to keep the costs down for her big day.
Planning my wedding seems so doable until I actually get involved in it. But I am the bride. My involvement is mandatory. Small. We'll keep it small and simple. I'm going to eat those words as sure as I'm going to eat cake. I start with the biggest questions. When and where? When is easy. My fiancé, Misha, and I want to get married during our favorite time of year, fall. Check one off the list. On to where? A hip Los Angeles restaurant. Velvet curtains, chandeliers, very romantic, until the crushing price tag. 20 grand for a Saturday night party. $20,000. Should I barf or laugh? Add tax, 18% service charge, and about $750 in valet parking for our guests? What are these crazy event planners thinking? Soon it becomes clear that it's me and not them. What am I thinking? I should have listened to Misha when he wisely suggested we run off to Reykjavik, but I have no family in Iceland. The only person I know there is Björk, and we've never met. We compromise, leaving the glitz of Hollywood behind for the quietude of wine country. Very practical. We can get vino by the case. Sparkling wine for everyone. I can toast to that. Bubbles make me merry. I call bakeries and florists and photographers while Misha takes on DJs. Deja vu. How can things possibly cost this much? The word wedding prompts instantaneous inflation. One photographer quotes a price range with the high end reaching the cost of a new car. Bar for laugh. So, we're getting married in a beautiful garden where flowers are already growing. The sunshine is free. At 2 a.m. the morning after our wedding, daylight savings ends and we gain a whole free hour. I say I do to that.
Michelle Phillippe is an actor, and she works here at Marketplace, where apparently she barfs and laughs a lot. And tune in next week for another installment of our Engaged series. Mike and Tiffany's wedding date has finally arrived. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
White House officials say the president
and the experts say usually
the Heritage Foundation estimates
it's like it's going to be the best quarter.
They decide what they're going to charge.
That has some veterans nervous.
It's time once again for our economics editor, Chris Farrell, to help you sort out what's smart, what's stupid, and what is the straight story. You know, Chris, it's August, and that means students are getting ready to head off to college. I believe your son is one of them.
Yep, my oldest is entering his senior year, and Tess, I have only one thing to say.
Okay.
How dare he?
Well, I'm sure you find it just a tad troubling that, you know, while he and his classmates are struggling to read Chaucer in Old English, or whatever they do in college these days, they're taking on a whole lot of debt to pay for that diploma.
And, of course, what I think is worse, we've learned over the past year, actually since the spring, many colleges, universities, have been taking, what's the right word? Payola.
Good word.
From student loan companies in return for preferential treatment.
Yeah, it really is a bit of a disgrace, isn't it?
It is, but there's a bigger disgrace. The huge profits student lenders make off student loans. James Zerwicki talked about this in a recent issue of The New Yorker. He says private lenders are costly and inefficient, but they pocket billions of dollars in subsidies every year.
Hmm.
Here's the straight story. Congress, refuse these loan sharks' campaign contributions, and wake up. It's time to start running the student loan market in the interests of students, not lenders.
Amen. Okay, we're done.
Okay.
No, I do have a question here.
Okay.
If Zerwicki's right, how are lenders getting away with running such a lousy business? How did we get here in the first place?
Well, I think there's two aspects of this that he emphasizes, and I agree with both. Part, it's ideology. A belief in privatization, that the private sector is more efficient than government. Now, he has this stunning figure. It's in the president's 2007 budget, shows that it's four times as expensive for the government to subsidize and guarantee private loans as it is for the government to issue those loans itself.
Now, why wouldn't it then just issue the loans itself?
Well, ideology. Part of it, though, is economic power. Student lenders, they're very savvy in the ways of Washington. They throw around campaign contributions. So between those two factors, we end up with a system that largely benefits the student loan companies. And there's one other aspect, though, and I think this just tosses in all fairness. You know, for a long time, we had a system that was heavily oriented toward grants. Student loans were important, but it was relatively small.
Mm-hmm.
What's happened now is mention college, and people say debt right away. That's what they think about. It's
right.
Debt. Because we've moved
right
away from a grant system. Absolutely. There's no question we moved toward a student loan system. And then the cost of college has gotten so expensive that for many students, it's like you're taking out a mortgage on yourself.
And you're paying for it for years and years and years after you graduate.
Exactly. So now it becomes a much more important issue.
So what would an alternative look like?
Well, I think that the federal government's direct loan business is one very clear alternative. Started in the 1990s, you can get your student loans directly from the government. Now, this is where you start seeing economic power, because the private lenders have really fought hard to try and limit, and they've succeeded in limiting the government's direct loan business. But one thing I learned from the article, which I didn't know, and I found this absolutely fascinating, is most of us admire the GI Bill.
Mm-hmm.
Opened up college to returning veterans. I think that you can look at much of the boom, post-World War II boom, to the GI Bill and all the human capital and all the knowledge that was created by that. Well, did the government go through middlemen? No. It just paid the colleges and universities directly.
So we need another one.
I don't think we need another GI Bill. But I think we should learn from the lessons of the past. And one of the lessons of the past is that it's highly efficient for the government to pay colleges and universities directly, or in today's world, for students to borrow directly from the government. I see no reason why private lenders should be among the most profitable companies in America. I mean, Sallie Mae, the largest private student lender, made $1.3 billion last year. It has a rate of return on capital that is the envy of Wall Street. This does not make sense to me. So let's cut out the middleman. Let's get the money to the students. That's what taxpayers believe they're paying for.
All right. The Straight Story from our man, Chris Farrell. Chris, thanks as always for lessons of the past and present.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, healthcare crises generate all kinds of tough decisions, but this one can literally end a marriage.
Okay, this is ridiculous. Okay, let's get a divorce. I was the one saying, I want a divorce, honey.
Marketplace Money is produced by Nancy Fargali with Rico Galliano, James Richter, Stephen Hoffman, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.